So, but the topic of today's lecture is efficiency, wages, and career concerns. According to the original plan of this course, I was planning to have a separate lecture on efficiency, wages, and a separate lecture about career concerns, but then I realized that I wouldn't have enough time to cover incentives in the detail that I wanted to cover them. So here we are, two lectures for incentives and instead one lecture for efficiency, wages, and career concerns. The efficiency wage story is very, very easy, both conceptually, mathematically, as well as intuitively. You work harder when you receive higher wage. Why do you work harder when you receive higher wage? It's because if you're caught shirking, you're out on the market and you may not find a job that which would pay you as much. There are some interesting elaborations which we will cover. The career concerns, the second half of today's lecture, it has some interesting mathematical ideas there, namely the Bayesian-Nash equilibrium, which we will also cover, and there will be some interesting questions on career concerns during tutorials. So do shake off and dust off your maths to be better prepared. Where do I start? I start with the following. I say, well, performance may be sometimes hard to observe. The harder it is to observe performance, the less strong incentives should be, the optimal strength of incentives. So that's why many firms don't bother practicing incentives. Does it mean that they don't incentivize their workers? No, it doesn't mean that they don't incentivize their workers. They motivate their workers using other ways. And the alternatives, of course, to incentives is monitoring. And the monitoring is imperfect or crude in the language of today's lecture. So you only check the worker out once at random at a particular point in time. It's a little bit like controllers in public transport. You don't have a controller in every bus. But sometimes, once in a while, you do have controllers looking at your tickets, and if you're caught, then there is a fine. So firms monitor the performance of their workers in this way too, and when they are caught shirking, they are fired, and so that's the idea behind the efficiency wage we will cover today. Now, another way to motivate workers, or another way to create an environment, an institutional environment, if you like, which motivates workers, is to say, look, guys, you are working for your reputation. What you're doing today, how hard you're working today, will determine your career, your income, your prestige, your status, whatever you care about in the future, right? So half of your life, you work for your name. Half of your life, your name works for you, right? This is the idea behind career concerns. And we're going to look at these two things, how they evolve. Now, efficiency wages have been practiced since time immemorial. The most famous, the most sort of widely cited example of efficiency wages is the example of what Henry Ford did in the beginning of 20th century. So it's more than 100 years ago. Back then, the automobile industry was evolving from workshops to mass production. And Ford's was one of the first factories that tried to mass produce cars. And so there was this conveyor, and the conveyor required good workers to operate. Because obviously if you have one worker hardworking on the conveyor, the other worker not so qualified, then the speed at which the conveyor is working will be determined by the speed of the worst worker, the weakest link. It didn't help that many of the car industry workers were unqualified, were drunk all the time, and would change employers several times a week or several times a month. So there was a huge employee turnover and huge absenteeism and huge accidents rate, etc., etc. So this was really not a very high class industry back then. And, you know, the wages were proportionately low, right? If you have not good workers, you can't pay them high wages and make a profit. So when Henry Ford raised the wages from $2 per day to $5 per day, to his workers, the market reacted with astonishment. You know, his friends told him, look, are you crazy? Or are you too much of a philanthropist? He said, well, I'm not a philanthropist. This is pure business. Because by offering high wage, I will attract the best people and I will motivate the people who are working for me to stick to working for me rather than look out for more lucrative opportunities. So by increasing the wage to $5 per day, what he did, he decreased the turnover, the employee turnover, so that he wouldn't have to spend so much time and energy training new workers how to operate a conveyor, obviously a financial gain. And he also managed to decrease the accidents rate and absence rates. So this contributed to a very high productivity increase. So not only was he able to break even, not only was he able to reap productivity gains that would be commensurate with this huge increase in daily wages, he actually made a profit on this. And this was one of the finest business decisions that he ever made, according to the book that his ghostwriter wrote for him. So this is a famous, famous example of efficiency wages. So what is the basic idea behind efficiency wages? Consider an environment in which pay is flat. In this environment, the marginal product of your effort is seemingly zero because wages are flat. But it's only seemingly so. Because what also happened is that from time to time, at random time intervals, firm monitor your performance, and if they find you shirking, if they find you reading your Facebook or Instagram instead of doing the invoices or contacting your key accounts, they will fire you. Yeah. So now this happens with a certain probability. So you could get away with shirking and continue being employed. But if you're unlucky, you're out. So there are lots of other firms on the market, okay? And if you're out, you can get a job on the market after perhaps some period of unemployment. So the labor market is perfectly competitive. There are lots of firms who want to hire you. Haha, right? If this is the case, then you will be rehired by another firm for by and large the same wage. What is the incentive for you to work if you can always find a job? The answer is yes, of course, there's no incentive for you to work if you can find the same similarly good job. Now, what is the incentive not to shirk? The incentive, if you want to incentivize your workers not to shirk, you've got to offer a higher wage than the market. Then the workers will have something to lose. If they have something to lose, maybe they will work harder, okay? But it's a good idea. If you have one firm which pays more and get workers who work rather than shirk, the market will look at it and the market will learn, and everybody on the market will increase their wages so as to keep their workers working hard. All firms will have to pay above market wages, and this situation will result in some very interesting theoretical predictions which match with some of the elements of the observed economic reality. So this efficiency wage theory is a very popular theory in labor economics. So let's look at the formal representation of efficiency wages. You have a market with N workers, and there is a little bit of unemployment on the market. How much will be determined endogenously within the model. So L of these workers are employed, which means N minus L are unemployed and looking for a job. Now you get a wage W, fixed wage, and for this wage you can either work, it costs you E, you can either put in effort level E, and the costs of effort are also E, or you can shirk, and that's going to cost you zero. So your wage is basically W, what you get at any point in time, T, minus your costs of effort. And these costs of effort can either be E or zero, depending on whether you work or shirk. Now, there is a probability Q with which, if you're shirking, you will be caught shirking. So think about it as a probability of finding a controller in public transport. It's not 100%, but it's not zero. For the 3.5 years that I've lived in Germany, I've seen controllers 2 times in my life. divided by the number of trips I took in public transport, maybe 5, it's very high probability, right? So that's your Q. If you're fired for shirking, you are unemployed. And if you're unemployed, you get an unemployment benefit of W bar. Now, with probability 1 minus Q, you can carry on shirking and you will not be caught. So, but if you work, if you pay for your fare in public transport, whether there's a controller or not, you will carry on working and you will carry on receiving a wage W. Now, on top of it, on top of the Q, on top of the probability of being fired for shirking, there is a probability B, another parameter of the model, there is a probability B with which you can lose a job no matter what. You know, your firm may go out of business, your job may be outsourced to India, your boss may not like you, etc., etc., etc. You may have conflict with colleagues, and this all happens with probability B. So what it means is it doesn't matter whether you work or shirk, with probability B you will be out of job and you will fall back on the generosity of the welfare system receiving the unemployment benefit W bar. So this is a summary of what can happen to workers and when. You can have your job terminated, and that's what's going to happen to you if you work and if you shirk. You can be caught shirking, and you can lose your job this way, which happens with this probability, in which case you're going to get these wages, depending on whether you work or shirk. Or you can be not caught shirking, and that's what's going to happen to you with whether you work, when you work and when you shirk. So this is a sort of, I think, handy summary of all the eventualities with the corresponding probabilities. Now, let's look at the worker side of the thing. The firms so far are taking a back seat. The firms are passive. The firms are not always going to be passive in this model, but here the workers are infinitely lived, and they maximize the present value of their utility, which is their wage minus the cost of effort. Now, the cleverest bit here is this one. What is it? This is the discount factor. We are in the world of continuous discounting, and this is what happens. This is by how much your income, your future income, which occurs at point T from now, is discounted. So this is a discount factor, and the parameter of this discount factor function is R, the discount rate. Have you seen it before? I'm sure you have. Those who have taken courses in finance, for them, it's just the usual thing of representing discounting. So there's nothing revolutionary here. It's quite normal. Now, under what conditions will you decide yourself to work rather than shirk? Or if you like it better, under what conditions will you decide to pay for your public transport use rather than not pay for your public transport use? To understand the purely economic rather than cultural motivations behind working hard, let us explore our model of working versus shirking by looking at what happens on a very, very short interval. Let's say between now and T seconds from now. Very, very short time interval, right? Why it's very short will become clear later on. So we take a very small time interval, and on this time interval, we work out what will be the net present value of the benefits from employment. Again, specific to this particular short time interval. Over this short time interval, you will generate some wages, which is your monthly wage times the length of this time interval, plus the discounted value of the expected benefits from being employed further. So what is this? This is the discount factor, that's clear. This is the probability B with which you will lose your job for no good reason. And over the period, over the time period between 0 and T, this probability becomes B times T, so it increases with time. And this is the net present value of your benefits from unemployment, basically your wage unemployment benefit W bar. Now, with probability 1 minus BT, you will get away and not lose your job, in which case you will continue getting the net present value of your benefit from employment. And we discount this because this is going to happen in the future from now. Okay, so this is basically, you know, a description on the slides that reiterates what I've said. Okay, so let's do one major simplification that will make our mathematical life much, much easier, namely the following. So you have a discount factor, and when t is small, that's why we take a very small time interval in our model. When the t is small, the following simplification, the following approximation roughly works. You're not convinced? Take this limit and it will answer all your questions. So when we use this simplification, we can write down the net present value from employment on the interval between 0 and t as the following expression, which is much easier to deal with. So when we rearrange it and take the limit, we get the net present value from employment, which is a function of the net present value of unemployment and some parameters of the model, namely the wages that you get, your intertemporal preferences, the interest rate R, and the probability with which you're going to lose your job for no good reason. Okay, so this is one result of the model. And of course, the employment benefits are the larger, the more wage you get. They are the lower, the more likely you are to discount the future, the more heavily you discount the future. And so the unemployment benefits are an insurance here. So now let us redo the same analysis as we did here, separately for the cases of working and shirking. You can try to practice this, and there is a tutorial problem which asks you to derive these expressions. In the lecture slides, they are given without derivation. So this is the present value of working when you're employed. So this is the N means not shirking. And this is the present value when you're employed from shirking. As you can see, when you work, your present value of employment is reduced by the effort that you put in your work. But when you shirk, you don't put any effort, but then you're running a higher probability of being unemployed and falling back on unemployment benefits. So once again, when is it profitable to work rather than shirk? It's profitable to work rather than shirk when the present value of the benefits from not shirking is higher than the present value of the benefits from shirking. When you solve this inequality, you will get the condition, the so-called null shirking condition, which the wage has to satisfy in order to motivate the worker not to shirk, right? So if the wage is at least as high as this expression, the worker will voluntarily decide not to shirk. The passenger, if the fine for not having a ticket is at least as high as this, the passenger will voluntarily decide to buy the ticket to save himself the financial trouble of having to pay the fine, right? So what does it depend on? It depends positively on the effort. The higher effort the firm wants the worker to make, the more the firm has to pay to the worker in order to, you know, make sure that the worker does decide to put in this effort. Now, the smaller the probability with which a shirking worker is detected, the higher the efficiency wage should be. Again, it makes a lot of sense. If this probability is very, very small, it's very, very unlikely that you will ever be caught shirking. So you can just as well just reduce your effort and shirk rather than work. In order to motivate you still to work rather than shirk, you have to pay a hell of a lot of money for the workers so that they will continue working rather than shirking. This element is the sort of unemployment insurance, the involuntary unemployment insurance. With probability B, you will lose your job because it's going to be shipped off to India. And the higher this probability is, the more money your workers should get in order to carry on working in this unstable environment. And the more generous the welfare system is, the more money you should offer to the workers to motivate them to work, because if they are caught shirking, if this thing is very large, then they may as well just start shirking in order to live off the unemployment benefits, which are generous. Okay, so this expression, I think, makes a lot of intuitive sense. Okay, now, one thing that is not, you know, clearly determined in this expression, well, one thing is the unemployment benefits. What are the unemployment benefits? What are we talking about when we talk, when we say unemployment benefits? Let's have a look. So, unemployment benefits are, you know, the net present value of unemployment benefits is not only the net present value of unemployment benefits is not only the, you know, the, sorry, this has to be W bar. It's to be W bar. It's not only the, you know, it not only has to do with the wage that you get, the unemployment benefit that you get with the W bar. It's also with the probability A, you will find a job. And with this probability, you will find a job, and once you found a job, you will face the net present value of the benefits from employment. Now, if you do the same steps as before that lead you to equation 2, redo it for the benefits from unemployment, and you'll get this expression, except that, of course, you'll have a... this W bar rather than W. Okay. So now, here's an interesting detail here. Now, if you're in unemployment, if you're unemployed, under what circumstances will firms decide to hire you? The firms will decide to hire you if you're going to work rather than shirk. So here comes the firms are stepping out of their back seat and decide to do something on the labor market. So for the firms, it's more profitable when the worker works rather than shirk. Therefore, the firms will design wages in such a way as to motivate the worker to work rather than shirk. That's why the net present value of employment benefits is not just the employment benefits whether you work or shirk, it's the benefits whether you work rather than shirk. So this expression becomes a function of the employment benefits when you not shirk, when you work rather than when you shirk. So this is a sort of subtle moment which takes perhaps a minute to understand. Now, so if we do some substitutions, now that we've expressed the unemployment benefits as a function of employment benefits, we can substitute the unemployment benefits back into the equations and the no shirking condition critically. So the no shirking condition now becomes purely a function of the reservation wage, the effort, the monitoring probability, the interest rate, and the job acquisition rate, and the job loss rate. Now, One last step in the derivation of the no shirking condition in the efficiency wage model is to consider what the job acquisition rate will be in equilibrium. So we are talking about the labor market equilibrium when labor supply equals labor demand. When labor supply equals labor demand in equilibrium, you have the outflows from employment, you have the number of people who quit jobs for whatever reason equal to the number of people who come to work for whatever reason, right? So the economy is neither growing nor contracting. We have a very stable environment, so if 100 people lose jobs, then 100 people should find jobs. If that's the case, then the outflows from employment, which is equal to the probability of unemployment times the number of people employed, should be equal to the inflows into employment, which is the number of people who are currently unemployed times the job acquisition rate. So if you do this, and you can express the job acquisition rate as a function of the parameters of your model, substituting which into the no shirking condition will give you the no shirking condition expressed in terms of effort, monitoring probability, job loss rate, and unemployment rate. So how can we interpret it? So how can we interpret it? What are the implications of the efficiency wage model? Implication number one, the efficiency wage must be at such level which exceeds the costs of effort. So look here. The efficiency wage in a not-shirking condition is equal to the costs of effort plus the opportunity costs of effort, the reservation wage. So far, so good, no problem. But then look at this guy. This term in this expression is strictly positive, right? And this is the premium that the worker gets in the environment where workers' effort is not observed to make him work. So it's an efficiency, the term efficiency wage is a little bit of an oxymoron, right? In a sense that it's nothing, it's anything but efficient. It's not efficient. Why is it not efficient? Because under efficiency wage arrangements, you are not delivering the highest possible efficiency to the economy. Why? Because remember, the efficiency is maximized when you're not wasting any money. Are you wasting money here? Yes, you are wasting money here because your wage is too high compared to the costs of effort that you want the worker to put in. Okay? You understand why? Because of the presence of this premium. Now, let's look at further implications. The second implication of the efficiency wage model is unemployment being a disciplinary device. Disciplinary device. This is really a new perspective on unemployment. What is unemployment, right? You have unemployment. It's the people who are out there on the market that are willing to work. Here's the International Labor Organization's definition of unemployment. It's the people who are willing to work, but who can't find a job. Okay? So why does unemployment happen? There are lots of theories why unemployment happens. In equilibrium, there should be no unemployment, by the way, right? In equilibrium, the supply of labor should be equal to the demand from labor. So whatever unemployment you observe has to be strictly temporary, very transient, you know, maybe a couple of weeks before workers find out the new vacancies, etc. But unfortunately, you have unemployment persistent and you have a fair share of unemployed people who have been unemployed for a long, long period of time. So you could think, okay, unemployment may result because there is a skills mismatch. You know, the economy requires one set of skills, the workers have a slightly different set of skills, and if the mismatch between the required skills and available skills is too large, you are going to be unemployed, okay? So, but here, in this model, it provides us a different perspective, a completely different perspective on why unemployment exists. According to the efficiency wage model, unemployment exists because it's needed as a disciplinary device. It's needed as a threat to the workers of what's going to happen if they don't work hard enough. Look here, if unemployment rate is zero, suppose everybody is employed. If unemployment rate is zero, then the no shirking condition will never be satisfied. Why not? Because this term, the premium for working hard, is going to be infinite. And no wage can possibly exceed the super high premium when unemployment is very low. So there's always going to be a little, there always should be a little bit of unemployment. How much depends on the other parameters of the model. There is always going to be some level of unemployment which exists for no good reason, no skill mismatch, no transition, nothing. It exists purely as a lesson to the people who are currently in work, in employment, as a warning to them that, look, that's what's going to happen to you if you are not working hard enough. This is, you know, this is one of the deeper implications of the efficiency wage model. So, now, another still deeper implication of the efficiency wage model is what's going to happen when you have a recession. You know, some years ago, a couple of years ago, we just got out of one of the major financial crises in the recorded history, the Great Recession. right, or whatever it's called. I think it's the Great Recession. And the economy really went down, unemployment increased, etc. But why should unemployment increase during recessions? Why should, the unemployment doesn't have to increase during recessions. If wages are flexible, then, you know, when there is a recession, the firms can say to their workers, look, guys, we're not doing very well financially, so maybe you could settle for a lower wage. Maybe we will cut some benefits. Maybe, instead of an Audi, we will give you a Skoda as a company car, etc., etc. And people should accept this because being in employment is still better than being unemployed, right? But that doesn't happen. Unemployment increases during recessions and systematically so. Why? Efficiency wages is the only theory that provides explanation to this phenomenon. And what it and why it happens is because, well, suppose there is a recession. When there is a recession, the demand for labor goes down. And if the market is purely fully competitive and flexible, the equilibrium wage should be less, but unemployment shouldn't increase, right? But if the equilibrium wage goes down, let's look at the no-shirking condition. This is your equilibrium wage. If it goes down, then people start shirking. And if people start shirking, the firms don't find it profitable, so the firms will never bring the wage down to the new equilibrium level under recession. The firms will always keep their wage higher than the equilibrium level. Not because they are philanthropists, not because they don't believe in markets, but as a disciplinary device. And as a result, when you have a recession, unemployment goes up because the wage in recession will never hit the equilibrium level required to keep the unemployment at the same level as before the recession. Now, there are a couple more implications of the efficiency wage model. One most interesting one is look at the Q parameter. Q is the intensity of monitoring. If you have a low monitoring intensity, so if you are unlikely to catch a worker who is shirking, you really have to pay a lot of money to prevent this worker from shirking. But if you can monitor your worker very precisely what this worker is doing, then your no-shirking condition predicts that the wage doesn't have to be very large. So what it means? It means that firms are making strategic choice. There's a strategic considerations in deciding how much to pay and how intensely to monitor people's performance. Remember, we looked at the monitoring intensity principle in the, I think, last lecture on incentives. I hope you still remember it. And what we discussed back then was that the strength of incentives and the precision with which you measure performance are determined simultaneously because one affects the other. Here, this is a similar story. The wage and the intensity of monitoring are determined simultaneously because the wage affects the lowest possible intensity of monitoring that you can have in order to keep workers still working. And given the intensity of monitoring, determines the lowest possible wage that you can offer to the workers for them to still work. There will be a tutorial problem that looks at this trade-off in a greater detail. So let's carry on. And so this is efficiency wages, the firm's choice. If you have a technology which gives you a higher intensity of monitoring, higher Q, you don't have to set so high a wage, but you have to pay for it. Now, if it's very, very expensive to monitor workers, your optimal Q is not going to be very high. If your optimal Q is not going to be very high, your efficiency wage should be higher to keep the workers on the non-shirking condition. Here is an interesting example. This is, I don't know if you've seen it, this is basically an example based on the data collected by the government of the Canadian province of Ontario. These are the average wages of men and women by firm size. So in smaller firms, less than 20 employees, this is the average hourly earnings of men and women. And in firms with more than 500 employees, the average earnings of men and women are higher. Question is why? Why do you pay more, higher wages in larger firms than in smaller firms? Efficiency wage theory gives a possible answer to this question. The answer is that in larger firms, it's harder to monitor people. You need to pay a lot more in order to detect people shirking in larger firms. Think about it. If you have a very small firm, probably just one office, one room, the boss is sitting in that room and the boss always looks at the workers and it's very, very easy to detect the worker shirking, or easier. Now imagine a very large firm with maybe lots of offices in different locations. It's much, much harder. You need to pay a lot more money to detect people shirking. So in larger firms where it's more expensive to monitor people, you've got to offer them more money in order to still keep them on the no shirking constraint. Now, so here's a slide on efficiency, wages and screening, but you know what, I think I will skip it. I will skip it because of the lack of time and because it's obvious. Now, let's move to something more interesting, namely the career concerns. And career concerns is a very, very deep theory. I didn't know it would be so deep. And very, very interesting. So what is the starting point? Why did people start thinking about career concerns? Here is Eugene Fama, the father of finance. I'm sure you've heard about this guy. Nobel Prize winner in economics, I think last year, right? So, and he wrote lots of papers, and one of the relatively famous papers by Eugene Fama, he made a case, he had an idea, and the idea of Fama was that, you know, everybody's talking about incentives, but look, guys, you don't need to have incentives. You don't need to have incentives because labor market will take care of motivating people. Well, we know from efficiency wage theories that labor market will take care to incentivize people, to motivate people by creating some unemployment as disciplinary device. But this idea is different. Fama doesn't say anything about unemployment. Fama says that, well, if you have a good worker, then the performance of this worker will be observed by the market, and the market will then hold this worker in high esteem. So if you work hard today, you form a good reputation for yourself, so next time you're on the market or next time you stand for promotion, your boss will be more likely to promote you based on your past performance. Okay. So if I want to be in good shape on the labor market, I should make sure that I produce lots of papers and have very high student evaluations, which means that perhaps I shouldn't be on the market anytime soon. But this is the career concern story, that the reputations that people build for themselves are going to act as a disciplinary device for them to motivate them into exerting high levels of effort. Very interesting idea. So can reputation give sufficient incentives so that incentive contracts are not needed? Can reputation replace incentives? Can reputation deliver a solution to the principal agent problem that is more efficient, if not fully efficient? We know that incentives in case of risk-averse people, in a risk-averse agents fail to deliver efficient solution. Incentives can only deliver efficient solution when the agent is risk neutral. So let us compare the solution that reputations can provide for the principal agent problem with the solution that the incentives can provide to the principal agent problem for the case of a risk neutral agent. So now, right now, we're going to look at risk neutral agents again. We know it's not true. We know that most of us are risk averse, but hey, let's assume that the agent is risk neutral. So what is the basic story? Agent works and his performance, not his effort, his performance is observed by the market. Who do we mean by market? By market, we mean other people, not necessarily the boss. Could be colleagues, could be subordinates, could be other firms, etc., right? So people work, and by working, they create reputation so that their performance is observed. Now, the market doesn't know how good workers are, because everybody has an incentive to say, I'm a super productive worker, but productivity is fundamentally unobserved. But the market, when the market sees the performance of the worker, the market gradually updates its knowledge about the likely ability that this worker should have, right? If you see a manager constantly creating a very large value for their organization, you see, this person must be quite high ability. And if you see another manager constantly failing, you see, oh, well, that's probably a loser. Yeah, probably, not certainly, because of course there are other factors and noise and such like. But you know what I mean. You gradually get more and more and more precise, although never perfect, idea about how able a worker is by observing this worker's past performance. Okay, so the worker knows that the market is watching him and tries to influence the beliefs that the market has about his productivity by putting in effort into his work today. To give you one good example, when I was preparing slides for this lecture, I encountered a couple of mathematical problems that I could solve because I didn't have the training in doing the maths behind the career concerns model. And I was thinking to myself, if I just do a blah blah lecture, what sort of reputation am I going to create? I have to go and study this maths myself to be able to derive the model and solutions to the questions formally rather than by hand waving. So I spent, there's been very good weather recently, right? So I spent a full Friday, a full Saturday, and yes, a full Sunday sitting in my stupid office, working on the slides for the career concerns model and on the tutorials. So I'm an agent who wants to manipulate the market's beliefs that he's high ability. Of course, I'm not high ability. But I want to create a reputation that I'm high ability. And in doing so, I work my ass off, right? So that's what agents do. That's what agents do on the market if they want to influence the market's perceptions about their ability. Why do they want to influence the market's perceptions about their ability? They want to get more money, right? And why would they get more money? Well, because ability is productive and wage is determined by the marginal product of labor. If you don't observe the ability, you have to base wages on the beliefs about the ability. So if you can manipulate the beliefs about your ability in order to manipulate the wages that will be offered to you next time. Okay, so, and the market knows that the agent has a strategic incentive to manipulate its beliefs about the agent's ability, and so we have a strategic interaction. Agent is trying to manipulate the market beliefs about his ability. The market understands this and offers to agents a certain wages that are profit maximizing, and so this strategic interaction has a number of very interesting implications, some of which we will cover in this lecture. So let's see how far we can get with the very interesting maths of the career concerns model, which I discovered in this semester. Okay, so here's the agent's output in period T. We are now dealing with the discrete time rather than continuous time, so it's, let's say, output at the every month or every year, doesn't matter. And the production function consists of three components. You have the ability, the eta, plus the effort, the A, plus the random noise. So your output may be high or low because your ability is high or low, or because your effort is high or low, or because you're lucky or unlucky. Your output is the result of these three factors. Now, ability is not known. I can't tell your level of ability. I can guess from your exam performance, for instance, right? But I can never tell that this person has ability level of so much, right? So effort is not observed either. What is observed is the output. And the question is, given the output observations, how do you make your beliefs about the ability that of the agent? So basically, how can you guess about eta when you only observe the Y? And this is a very difficult question, right? It's a little bit like trying to work out how much my salary is by observing how much money I spend on coffee, right? But we're going to try and do it. We're going to try and do it in this lecture. And to do this, we need to employ some mathematical structure. Namely, we are going to assume that labor market is competitive. As a result of this assumption, we get a very convenient assumption, a very convenient specification that wages, the wages offered to the agent by the market at time t, is the expected value of the output that the agent is expected to produce at time t. So basically, agent gets the full product of his output. Yeah? Why not? The agent will get the full product of his output when the labor market is perfectly competitive. So it's okay. Right? Now, more interesting question is, this expectation is conditional. It's not unconditional, right? It's conditional. So you form expectations about how much output this agent will produce today based on the history, based on the history of performance that this person has generated in the past. So this y upper script t minus 1 is a vector, is the vector of the output levels that this person has produced in the past, starting from the beginning of observations. Okay? So this is the wages equal to the conditional expectation of today's output on the history of observation. The agent maximizes his net utility, just a moment, which is the difference between the wages that the market is going to offer to him based on his performance, minus the costs that it minus the costs of effort, times the discount factor. This is discount factor, okay. Beta. Yes. So now, given this setup, we can immediately see, we can immediately work out the efficient or first best level of effort. The first best level of effort is basically the difference between the output minus the costs of effort. So differentiate this difference with respect to effort. You will have 1 here and C prime of A here. So the optimal first best level of effort is determined from this condition. So once you have the costs of effort, you can immediately see how high should be the optimal level of effort. Okay? The question is, will the agent ever put in the optimal level, the efficient level of effort under career concerns? And the short answer is no. But let's carry on. Now, how do we solve this model? We have a model in which the market offers wages to the agent, and agent chooses the levels of effort at each period in time in order to maximize his utility, right? So it's a strategic interaction, and not only is it strategic, it's also dynamic. So it's a dynamic model. Unlike the principal-agent model which we used to think about incentives, it was a one-off interaction. There was no future or no past. Here there is a future and there is a past. So in order to solve the career concerns model, which is a game theory model, we have to use the method of backward induction. And I'm sure that you have come across the method of backward induction in your microeconomics course, which is a prerequisite for this course. So you have a dynamic game. That's where it starts. It's an example. That's where it starts. The gray player makes his move. Then the green player, given the move of the gray player, makes his move. This is where the game ends. And to solve this model by backward induction is to solve it from the back. So you look at the end of the game and you determine the optimal action that the green player will take at each eventuality. So it's out when the gray does adds, and it's in when the gray does no adds. So this is going to be the optimal, and this is going to be the optimal. And then you turn to the gray will think, okay, the green will do out if I do add, and he will do in where I do no add. I look at my payoffs and I choose the payoff which is the highest for me, so I will go add. And this sequence of black arrows is called subgame perfect Nash equilibrium, and the solution to this game, basically the rules that the actions that people take, is this. So this is the method of backward induction, and we're going to use it in the application to solving the career concerns problem for a very simple case when there are only two periods of time. We will, if we have time, we will consider the case when there are more than two periods of time, but let's make sure we understand what happens when big T is equal to 2. So when big T is equal to 2, we have the following, let's just write down the agent's utility maximization problem. It's the sum of the discounted net utilities. So we don't discount in the first period, and we do discount in the second period. Now we use the perfect labor market assumption here, and we replace the wage in the second period by the expected value of output in the second period, given the history of output in the first period. Okay, so we just write it down in a more explicit way. Here comes my first question for your practice. For your practice, try to understand why we replace the wage in the second period with its conditional expectation, and we don't do such replacement in the first period. Try to understand why. Let's move on. So, what is the conditional expectation of output in the second period given the output in the first period? Remember, output is equal to the sum of ability, effort, and random noise. Random noise, its expectation, conditional or unconditional, is always equal to zero. So by taking expectation, we get rid of the random noise. So what is the conditional expectation of ability? Well, it's just the conditional expectation of ability. It's a number. What is the conditional expectation of effort? The effort is not a random variable. The effort is a decision variable by the agent. And so when we take conditional expectation of output given on the history of past performance, the level of effort that the agent will take in period 2 is A star 2. Whenever we say star, we mean equilibrium, right? So this is the equilibrium level of effort that the agent is expected to take, costs of effort in the first period, wages in the first period, and what remains of the wage in the second period. Now, when you look at this expression and you want to maximize it with respect to the level of effort in the first period and the level of effort in the second period, what should be the optimal level of effort in the second period? Well, C prime of A2, 0, 0, 0, 0. If you take derivatives of all these guys with respect to A2, you get zeros. Now, question number 2 for your self-practice. Why is the derivative of the equilibrium effort in the second period with respect to the effort that the agent will take in the second period? Why is it equal to zero? Try to understand this. Okay? I'm just giving it to you as a fact. So, you have given that A2, the equilibrium A2 is zero in period 2. Intuitively, it means there is no future, so why should you work for your future if there's none? So A2 is equal to zero, so that we can get rid of these guys. W1 is a constant. It can't be influenced by the agent. So we can reduce the problem, the agent's utility maximization problem, to a much simpler statement, which is this. So the agent's intertemporal utility maximization problem for a two-period career concerns game is really coming from this very simple expression. It has the costs of effort in the first period, and it has the benefits of effort in the first period. The benefits of effort in the first period come in the form of the wage in the second period, because the wage in the second period will depend on the agent's ability. Now, we don't observe the agent's ability, but what we do observe is the output in the first period, and based on this observation, we can try and guess what the agent's ability is. So this is the benefit of agent's effort. This is the cost of agent effort. There exists an optimal level of agent's effort which maximizes this difference. So let us try to find this optimal level of effort. Now, the key in doing so is to understand what this is. It's not a number. It's a function of A1. Why is this a function of A1? Because Y1 is a function of A1. Okay? So you need to get an expression for this guy, which will be a function of A1. And that's what we're going to do right now. And the method we're going to use is the method called Bayesian updating. Have you heard of Bayesian updating? Sure you have. In your econometrics courses, in your statistics courses. The story is very simple. You do Bayesian updating all the time in your life. It's very, very, it's not difficult, okay? So I'm going to give you a very gentle, easy example for you to understand the idea, and then we're going to apply this in the case of the career concerns model. So consider two events. Agent has high ability, and agent's output is high. So you know from, say, I don't know, wherever, from previous history, you know that there is the agent is high type with probability pH, and 1 minus pH with probability 1 minus pH, the agent is bad. So you know from your previous experience that with certain probability a professor is really a nice guy, and with 1 minus this probability the professor is a jerk. So P of H is given to you, right? You also observe when the output is high and when the output is low. You can observe the frequency with which you are happy with your lecture and the frequency with which you're not happy with your lecture, right? So you can again determine the probability with which the agent delivers a good lecture and not so good lecture, okay? So you also know that if a professor is good, then chances are that the lecture, the course that he will deliver, will be good, will be high quality. Not always. There are some good professors who are really bad at teaching, like myself. Okay? So this probability is not 100%, or not always 100%. Now, suppose you actually observe, you have no idea about how good I am, but suppose, imagine in a parallel universe that you're actually happy with my course, right? So the outcome of this course is high, right? You actually observe event E. What is the probability that given your observation, the professor is actually a good professor? Okay? So what is the probability? And it's very easy to work it out. Because look, the probability of having a good course is the sum of these components. What do they mean? A professor can be good or bad. A professor is good with probability P of H, and with the with this probability, the professor will deliver a good lecture. But, you know, even if professor is not good, it could happen that your lecture will still be good. So this event doesn't have zero probability either. So you can write down the probability of having a good course as the sum of these products of conditional probabilities. Now, which event are you interested in? We are only interested in the event in which the agent is high type. So you're only interested in this part. So what is the probability that given that the output is high, the agent is high ability type? It's equal to this probability divided by all the possible events that you can observe, which gives you the Bayesian formula. Read more about it on Wikipedia. Excellent source. Read up on this. It may look complicated. In fact, it isn't, once you practice it a little bit. Yeah? So this is the Bayesian formula. It says the probability of the agent being high type given his performance is some function, is some algebraic function of the unconditional probability that the agent is high type, the unconditional probability that high performance will be delivered, and the conditional probability with which high performance is delivered given that the agent is high type. Now, let us try to convert these insights into something helpful to solve our career concerns problem. So, basically, we convert these probabilities into the probability density functions, because remember, effort is continuous, so we need to use probability density function rather than a discrete probability. Then the same formula becomes this. The same formula becomes this. Now, This integral is nothing but the unconditional probability of the unconditional probability density function of f of output in the first period. This is the conditional probability density function of the output given the agent's ability level, and this is the probability density function of the agent's ability level. Now, this probability density function we're not interested in. It's just a coefficient. It's a coefficient which does not depend on eta. Because it's the probability density function of output for all agents. So therefore, this probability density function, from which we're going to get the beliefs about eta, given the past performance, is proportional. This half infinity sign means proportional to. It's not equal, but proportional to. It's like this thing is equal to this thing times a number. 5, for instance, right? So you don't care about the number, you only care about this. Okay, so how do we get this? Well, we know the probability distribution function of eta. What is the probability distribution function of eta? Let's get back to the model. The model says that eta is normally distributed with a certain mean, m0, and a certain variance, which is equal to 1 over h0. What is H0? H0 has a special name in statistics, it's called precision. So you can either say standard, you can either say variance, or you could say precision. The variance and precisions are opposite to each other. So this is the P of eta is given to us from the assumption of the model. The P of eta is given to us from the assumption of the model. What is this? Well, this is the conditional probability distribution function of output in period 1, given that the agent is type eta. How do we get this? Okay, so this is the probability distribution function of ability type of the agent. It's just a normal distribution. Don't tell me you haven't seen it before. Now, and this is the conditional. This is the conditional probability distribution of y1 given the eta, right? So what is y1 given the eta? Given the eta, y1 will have the expected value of a1 minus eta, because epsilon is going to have zero in be zero in expectation. And the only thing that is stochastic in y1 is the random noise epsilon, and the random noise epsilon has a normal distribution with mean 0, and the variance equal to 1 over h epsilon, where h epsilon is, by analogy with h0, is the precision with which performance is observed, with which performance is a measure of the agent's ability and effort level. It's basically how well you can measure effort from the agent's performance. Now, the Bayesian formula says that in order to get the probability density function of ability given the output, you basically have to take the product of this guy and this guy. So let's do it. We take a product of these two terms, and after some boring algebra, I'm not going to go through these details. I gave them to you to practice, so make sure you understand these calculations. It's boring, but it's not difficult. Rearrange this, substitute that, and what you get is that the conditional probability distribution of ability given output is normal with this mean and this variance. Now, what, speaking of learning, what do we actually learn from this? Yeah, why is it helpful? Well, it's helpful for us because now we have the conditional expectation of ability given the effort level, equilibrium effort level. Okay, so and now we can solve our utility maximization problem as a function of the effort that the agent will decide to take in period 1. We also learn from this expression a couple of other interesting things. So this is the most important. Now we can solve our utility maximization problem. But there are a couple of other interesting things we learn. First of all, we can see how learning about performance in period 1 is informative about the ability of the agent. look, your beliefs about the agent ability depend on how well he has worked before. The higher is the output in period one, the higher your beliefs are about the agent's ability. Makes a lot of sense, right? If I see someone who has generated lots of profits, I say, this is a very high ability manager. Maybe. Maybe he is a total waste of time. Maybe he's been lucky all the time, but chances are that he's high ability. We're in the world of chances here, right? Now, we also see that the precisions with which we observe ability and with which we observe output also matter. They matter in a simple but non-trivial way. So the importance of new information for changing beliefs depends on the precision of the signal from Y1. The more precise this signal is, the more precisely you can measure performance, the more important your performance, your past performance is for forming beliefs about your ability. So to get back to, what's your name, Carolina? To get back to Carolina's question, she said, well, what if last year there was a big shock and it wasn't clear whether bad performance is due to ability or due to some circumstances? Could be. In which case, you're not measuring your output very precisely, so your H epsilon is very small, let's say zero, right? And then whatever you learn about past performance is simply not informative, right? And if H0 is equal to zero, then your conditional expectation is the same as in the past, which is average M0. But if it's informative, if it's precise, then you learn a lot. So the extent to which you update your beliefs depends on how precise your measure of performance is. Again, simple, intuitive, yet not trivial mathematically. So now we have the right instrumentarium with which to solve the agent's utility maximization problem. We write it down as a function of A1, the effort that the agent chooses, take the first order condition, and voila. What we see is this. This is the first order condition for the optimal effort in period one, and the optimal effort in period one is not efficient. Why is it not efficient? Well, we know that the efficient level of effort should be equal to 1 to maximize welfare. We know it. But the optimal level of effort is strictly less than 1. Strictly less. It's equal to the beta, the discount factor, which is already less than 1. And it's also equal, what's even worse, it's equal to the ratio between the precision of the performance signal and the sum of the precisions of the ability and performance signals. And this ratio is obviously less than 1. So you have something less than 1, you discount things, and you have something less than 1 here. What is the economic interpretation of what we observe? Well, there are two reasons why the agent's effort is below the efficiency level. One reason is you make your effort today, but you get the reward from this effort tomorrow. Between today and tomorrow, there's time, and you discount it. And this comes with the factor beta. So that's what the beta is doing here. But there's a second reason, more interesting. The second reason says, look, your ability is not observed. Let's face it. It's not observed. The only way for the market to learn about your ability is to observe your performance. Your performance isn't going to be measured very precisely. Your ability is not measured very precisely. So you, every extra unit of effort that you take is going to cost you the price of 1 unit of effort. But the marginal benefit of the unit of effort in terms of your, in terms of beliefs about your ability, the marginal benefit is going to be equal to this ratio. Okay? That's what you see. That's what you see here. So agents don't work as hard as the efficiency dictates because the reward for their work comes later and because the gains, reputational gains, are less than proportionate to the expenditure of effort that people put in. So to summarize, what we see is a rather bad situation in which the agent doesn't work at all in period two. So he does produce some output because he's so big, which is equal to his ability. But he doesn't put any effort. And in period one, the agent works good, thank you, agent. But the level of effort that the agent puts in is less than the efficient. Question is, can we have a career concerns model? Can we have a situation in which career concerns or reputational concerns will result in the level of output which is close to efficient? And the answer is yes. All we need to do is we need to say, come on, there are more than two times time periods. You know, the pension age in Germany is 67 and going up. You graduate from university at the age of 25, give or take, right? So you have 40 odd years to work and 40 periods times maybe 12 to show, to send the signal to the market about how high or how low your ability is. So let us try to extend the career concerns model to increase the T. Now here is the statement of the agent's utility maximization problem for an arbitrary long time horizon. Why is it arbitrary long? Because big T is just a parameter. Here you can have T as little or as high as you like. Using the same logic as before, you can write down this utility maximization problem in terms of conditional expectation. So far, so simple. The most interesting part here, which took me a weekend to figure out, is this. How do we get the probability density function of eta conditional on the history, the entire history of outputs that the market observes? And the solution is quite simple. The solution is basically use the Bayesian updating formula, except that now this conditional probability density function is proportional not only to the product of one conditional performance, but all the performance outcomes ever observed for this agent enter into this probability density function in a multiplicative way. Now, in the tutorial, you will be offered the chance to work out what it's equal to just go through the derivations. It's boring. It's not particularly insightful. You just have to rearrange things here and there. Took me a lot of time, but you should go through it and try to arrive at this expression. So this is the probability density function of the ability of the agent given the entire history of his performance. And what it says is that it follows a normal distribution. The mean of this normal distribution is this guy, and the variance of this distribution is this guy. Now, but qualitatively speaking, not much has changed. This is your sum of your total performance outcomes that you have ever generated. This is your initial ability level, and this is the precision with which you can measure ability and precision with which you can measure performance. So again, if you can measure performance very precisely, so H epsilon is going to be very high, the beliefs about ability are updated very quickly. If not, the beliefs about your ability are not updated at all. Let's put this thing back into the agent's utility maximization problem. And what we get is this. Now, this is when the things become really interesting. Because look what you see here. You need to maximize this utility with respect to the effort level at each period of time. So if you have t equal 1,000 years, you have to maximize it with respect to A1, A2, A3, A1,000. If you have an infinite time horizon, then things become even more interesting. So without further ado, we need to take the first order condition from this business, and we need to differentiate this function with respect to A1, A2, A3, etc. This is not trivial. The derivatives of the agent's utility with respect to the effort level taken at each period look like this. And the trick is, try to do it at home. You know, to do well on this course, you have to make sure you can derive everything by yourself. So try to do it at home. The trick is, you have to see where a particular a is present in the function. So let's take a equal 1, you see it. Let's take a equal 1 to start with. So where is a1 present? A1 is present here for t equal 1. Okay. Now, what about here? What about this part? Where is a1 here? Well, if t is equal to 1, no a1 here. If t is equal to 1, then this sum is until 0. And if this sum is from 1 to 0, it's equal to 0. So a1 is not present here. Yeah. And a1 is not present here either because it's just a number. It doesn't depend on a at all. Okay. Let's look at t equal 2. Let's look at t equal 2. T equal 2. So t equals 2. Do you have a1 here? No, you don't, because this is a2. When t equals 2, you have this, you have 0, plus when t equals 2, you have beta to the power of 1 times this, times the sum where s goes from 1 to 1 of these guys. So instead of the sum, you're just going to have eta plus a1 minus epsilon 1 minus a1 equilibrium. A1 star, right? So when t is equal to 2, you have a1 present here. When t is equal to 1, you have a1 present here. But t can go from 1 to t, to big T. So you have a1 present here and here at the same time. Now when small t is equal to 3, you have t3 here. When small t is equal to 3, then this thing is going to be the function of two terms. So it's going to be beta to the power of 1 times this thing, times eta plus a1 plus epsilon 1 minus a1 star. But remember, small t is equal to 3. So it has to be also plus this term times eta plus a2 plus epsilon 2 minus a2 equilibrium. So you have a1 here, and a1 comes with the coefficient of beta squared times this ratio. So look here. When t is equal to 2, a1 comes with this coefficient, so the partial derivative of the function with respect to a1 is this. When small t is equal to 3, it comes with this coefficient. When small t is equal to 4, this is the most interesting part. When small t is equal to 4, you have beta to the power of 4 times this coefficient times the sum from 1 to 3 of all these guys. But from 1 to 3, so a1 is present here as well. So taking a derivative, you get this component. When t is equal to 5, well, you get the idea. Where is a2 present? a2 starts to be present in the utility maximization function starting from t equals 3. a3 starts to be present in the utility maximization function starting from t equals 4. And so on, and so on, and so on. If you do it with pen and paper, and if you really spend some time on this, I'm sure you'll see the pattern. Very simple pattern you will see very soon. Just try to do it. Okay? So these are your first order conditions. And I'm sure you see the pattern in this condition. So for every effort level, for the effort level in each period, the first order condition for every effort level in each period is determined by this sum. Notice the difference. When you have a simple two-period career concerns model, A2 in the final period was strictly zero, and A1 was just beta times this ratio. This is just a generalization. What is the optimal level of effort for the fifth period? Well, it depends on how many years you have. And if you have many enough years, it's going to be the sum from the where S is from 5 till the end of your observations of all these components. Now, why am I spending so much time on this? Because, and I will need just a few more minutes. I know it's the end of the lecture, end of the day. I just need a few more minutes, and then we will part. So, one implication that you see from this result is that for effort levels at large T's, for effort levels later on in the worker's career, the first order conditions imply that these effort levels are going to be lower and lower and lower.
Yes.
Well, junior people work harder than senior. Why? Because of this. The junior people have more incentives to create reputations for themselves. The senior people have already created certain reputations for themselves, either good or bad, right? So they don't need to prove anything to anyone anymore, right? But the junior people, whose ability is very uncertain and not known to the market, they work very, very hard to establish a reputation on which they can, to which they can later use to enhance their wage and other labor market prospects. So this is, yes, this is precisely the major implication of this, that the marginal value of effort for more senior people is less because their reputation is more or less formed. For the junior people is higher, so they work harder. Now, let's get back to Fama's idea about labor market acting as a reputation creating device and can replace incentives. Is it true? Yes and no. It could be under some values, and I think there will be a tutorial question, I'm not sure, but probably there will be, asking you to show that there exist values of beta and T such that sometime some levels of effort in some period of history, of working history of an individual, they will actually work harder than the efficient level. So if you have a long enough time horizon and patient enough people, so that not so low beta, they will actually at some point in time work extremely hard, much harder than the efficiency considerations dictate. Why? Because they need to create reputation for the future. But by and large, if you look at the stationary level of effort, if you look at the level of effort which is in the equilibrium, the level of effort which is in the equilibrium is zero, which is a, you know, a contradiction to the idea of Fama, who said that managers create reputations and incentives are not needed because you have reputation. Well, you could reconcile these two ideas. They both make sense because Fama's argument says that, you know, it's not an equilibrium argument. Fama isn't talking about what will happen at the end of managers' careers. Fama is talking about what's happening in the middle of managers' careers or in the beginning of managers' careers when they have the highest reputational concerns. And it could be that the length of time under sufficiently long length of time and under sufficiently large beta, it could be that managers in the beginning of their careers are working even harder than efficiency considerations dictate. But by and large, we can't say always and in every case, we can't say that reputational concerns are important enough to generate the levels of effort which are comparable or higher than the levels of effort that simple incentive schemes can generate. Now, there is an interesting, this is the last thing I'm going to say in this lecture, there is a very interesting case of this career concerns model, which will be offered to your attention during the tutorial. The case is, well, so far we looked at the model in which ability was fixed. So you were born with a certain level of ability. There are some high ability people, some low ability people. There is ability distribution. But for a given person, the ability is the same at all periods of their working life. During the tutorial, you'll be offered an interesting problem in which we relax this assumption, in which we allow ability to follow some random walk process. And there you will see that efficiency, reaching the efficient level of effort, is in principle possible. So enjoy learning new things about career concerns and Bayesian updating. No lecture next week. See you on the 13th of June. All the best.